I wanted to ask you one thing about the, you've mentioned economics, and of course that worrying about the economic side of the of engineering, as it were, played a very important part from here on out. What about your training, though, up to this point? How did the training of chemical engineers at the time you went through that, was there any, how much emphasis was there on the economic side of chemical engineering?
Minimal, absolutely minimal. And it was a big deficiency as far as my background is concerned, and something I'm proud to see more recent curriculum seem to take into more account than they did at the time I was going through. But certainly the recognition that the bottom line has got to be the determining line in the whole sheet is a pretty doggone important thing to get over at an early stage. That's one of the things, now I must say, one of the things that the, again, the MIT practice school experience brought home, that there is a bottom line that's got to be met, and no matter how fancy your equations may be, the fact of the matter is, if they don't make money for the company, they're not going to be very popular.
Does that separate the academic engineer from the practicing engineer?
Well, I guess sometimes it does. In my money, it's an essential ingredient in any well-rounded engineer, be he academic or practical, because you don't really appreciate what you're doing even at the scientific level unless you have some idea of how it's going to fit into the scheme of things, I think. I mean, that may be the practical engineer's interpretation of a well-rounded engineer.
The move here to Hunterville in 1950, I think.
Yes.
How were you selected for that move?
Well, I don't know. All I know is that I was notified one day that I had been appointed the director of the chemistry division at Gulf Research and Development Company, and I was expected to report there as soon as convenient. And I had never, in my whole career, Gulf or anywhere else, turned down an assignment or asked for a raise. And I've never been disappointed in following the judgment of my bosses in those respects. Obviously, it was an opportunity, and I knew enough about the situation to know that this was a big step forward. Mm-hmm. And I was delighted by the prospect. I frankly approached the move with a lot of temerity because, after all, we had come back from UOP for the purpose of settling down in Port Arthur to make our home and raise our family and put our roots down and be a member of the Port Arthur community and the refinery, and I expected to work the rest of my life in the Port Arthur refinery just like my dad had and have a great life in Port Arthur, Texas. So it represented a major traumatic change in the whole outlook, family-wise and every way. And it was a traumatic experience for the whole family. But it was clear that it was a step forward in the thing to do. And as it turned out, it was. But it was part of Dr. Foote's and the corporation's determination to bring about a better utilization of Gulf's technical potential. And they thought that bringing a fella in from the operating side, more or less the operating side, into the research establishment would help bridge that gap a bit. And I guess to some extent it did.
What was the R&D group like when you joined it here?
Well, it was a big, effective first-class research organization. Their main claim to fame had been in the exploration side more than in the product and process side. In particular, they were pioneers in geophysics, and the airborne magnetometer was a Gulf Research development, which was a very big factor in early exploration efforts. And seismic technology, they were very strong in. They were strong in geology. They were strong in production in the sense of enhanced recovery and that sort of thing, and reservoir engineering. The process and product side, which was about half the labs as far as people were concerned, was somewhat more amorphous and not nearly as focused, and not frankly didn't have much in the way of solid accomplishment to wave the flag about. Partly it was people involved who were fine folks, but largely quote academic types. Partly it was the reluctance of the operating people to accept what Gulf Research came up with, both product and process development wise. Partly it was just the inherent difficulty of transfer of information from one to the other. I was able, I think, to a degree anyway, to help solve some of these difficulties. And we, I believe, by the time I left the research lab in 1955, I guess it was, I believe we had somewhat improved the stature of the product and process into the business with the operating people, and it made some significant contributions, of which the HDS process was probably the outstanding example, although there were some others, especially in the catalytic cracking area, some definite improvements.
Yes, you had there was a major paper, at least I thought it was, in the Petroleum Refiner about the HDS process, and there were several others at the same time in which you really described the results of this long research project.
Mm-hmm.
You and, what are the other names, Montgomery, Hirsch, Horn, Summers, those
names are all familiar. They were all that you mentioned, were members of the so-called Panel 2 of the Research Advisory Committee, which the corporation had set up, and we were the panel that was responsible for this development. Jack Summers was my successor in running the pilot plant in Port Arthur when I was transferred.
You've mentioned several times this less than friendly relationship between R&D and operating people. Mm-hmm. What's the basis for that? Or what
nature.
Was the basis for it?
Human nature. Just the very understandable and common characteristic that I'm smarter than you, and therefore what you know is not that important, and what I know is a lot more important. Which is dumb, of course, but it's true, and unfortunately we're all human beings and are subject to it. I think, in addition to that, which was a basic reason, there may have been in the past some more substantive reasons of promises made and not kept, and claims made that didn't pan out, and a lack of confidence in what the technical people said, partly through their ignorance and partly through maybe misapplication. So there's responsibility on both sides. I don't pinpoint either side or any person.
You said that you had in your practice school days, had a way of sort of bridging that group. Is there anything specific in what you did?
No. It's just something that you either do or don't. And I guess it's a God-given talent or lack thereof.
What's the situation today in that relationship? Has that changed?
Well, of course, Gulf no longer is there, and Gulf Research is no longer there. So that specific problem is not with us anymore. But I think that the basic tensions are potentially there in any organization. I think it's the nature of the beast, and we'll never completely get away from it, and it's something that's got to be worked on in any organization all the time.
By 1955, excuse me, you were came up here in 1950, but in 52 they must have had eyes on you for something, because you took the management course at Pittsburgh.
Right. And that was a very significant development for which I'm grateful. I was at a pretty responsible level from a technical standpoint, but I had had substantially zero exposure to the real world of business and all that. And this was an opportunity at least to get some inkling that there is another world out there besides chemistry and chemical engineering, process and product development. It was really my first exposure to the non-technical end of our business or any business, and it was a wonderful experience. It was 8 weeks, as I recall, and very intensive 8 weeks, and the group was an interesting group of industry and government people, military and others, and from all industries. Several, I think there were two or three of us in that class from Gulf, but there were some other oil industry people as well. And I think the main thing that I got out of it, and I think most of us got out of it, was realizing that not all of the problems were our problems, and that other people had similar problems wherever they were, mm-hmm. and in whatever industry they were. And there was a lot of similarity between the various battles we were fighting. And so what you learn by way of real economics and finance and marketing and all that wasn't all that much. It was just an introductory course for that, but at least it gave you some speaking acquaintance with some of the jargon and some appreciation of the importance of some of these other elements when you put them together to make a business. So it was a good time for me, perfect time for me, just exactly when that sort of a course should have been given, and I was given the opportunity to do it.
Did you feel at this point, I mean, you had said you were going to spend the rest of your life at the refinery in Port Arthur.
That's what I thought.
But now you're seeing a whole different world. Were you excited about the possibilities that were opening up for you?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, because I've been, again, a lucky fellow in that each job that I've had throughout my career, wherever it has been, UOP or go, I had thought was the best job in the company. And I was completely satisfied with it, and I was perfectly happy to do what I was doing and do it as well as I knew how to do. I guess in the back of my head there was the thought that if I do a good job, maybe there'll be something even better coming along. But as far as pointing toward the future and saying I want to be here or there or yonder, I never got into that. It just all seemed to work out. In that respect, I guess I'm extremely fortunate, because not everybody is that lucky. But I was, and sure, I was excited by the new prospects each time I took on a new job. But it was to learn the new job, and I regarded it as that rather than a stepping stone to something bigger and better.
Mm-hmm.
You've done an amazing amount of research. You know more about me than I do, for goodness sake. I'm astonished.
Even though I have the wrong Jerry McAfee in there a few times.
Well, but, that's all right. You might improve the situation by including him.
I don't think so. In 55, you became vice president of engineering. This says refinery department. I'm not aware of how that was all organized and what that meant.
At the time, Gulf was organized into several major departments. There was the production department, which included exploration. There was the manufacturing department, which was primarily refining. And there was the marketing department. And then, of course, legal and all that. But the financial. And the big shots of Gulf were the vice presidents or senior vice presidents of those respective departments, and they were really the barons of the company, as it were. When Mr. Whiteford, W.K. Whiteford, became chairman and CEO of Gulf, he undertook a major reorganization of the company, and part of that reorganization was bringing me into the refining department to spread the wings, as it were, of the then senior vice president who ran the refining department, as a one-man show. Very strong man, very able man, did a heck of a good job, but he was one man. And Mr. Whiteford's concept, really, so far as the manufacturing part was concerned, was to get some other guys in there to make a team rather than relying on one man. And I was brought in to be the technical team, the engineering guy. There was also an operating guy and what they called a coordinator who was supposed to tie it all together. But basically that was the reason I was brought in, and it was to broaden the manufacturing department's scope, as it were, and again to further the ties between the technical end of the business and the operating end of the business, with the idea that here Gulf has spent beaucoup millions of bucks on this research lab, and they weren't really getting their money's worth out of it. A lot of them thought it. With a certain amount of justification. And if there was anything we could do to foster better utilization of that investment, well, that's something they wanted to do. And that was part of it. Also at the time, part of Mr. Whiteford's philosophy was that you don't really need a big engineering department. And that he and I had some strong disagreements, but he was the boss. And his philosophy was we'll streamline the engineering department down to a minimum. We'll rely on outside contractors. And we'll have a small elite group of real smart people who will contract out and get other people to do the job for us a lot less expensively than doing it ourselves. Well, that was not the Gulf way of doing it. That traditionally Gulf had built up a very big and strong engineering department, which did its own engineering and did a lot of the construction actually in their refineries over the years. And this was not Mr. Whiteford's concept. And as it turned out, I think he was right, because we had gotten too big and too fat and too hierarchish. And entity unto itself, and it had kind of lost touch with what the real purpose of the business was, which was to make money out of the oil business. So part of my job, which was not the part I enjoyed the most, was the downsizing of the engineering department and streamlining of it. And we accomplished it. We did it. And I think we did it pretty well. And I think Mr. Whiteford, in the long run, was right that we were a better, leaner, faster, more responsive group at the end than we were at the beginning. But it was it caused me a lot of heartache at the time.
Well, you moved into that position, you were, what, 39, 40 years old?
Let's see, I became vice president in 1955, so I was just 39, just, you know, about to turn 40.
Right.
Which was a fairly tender age at which to become a corporate vice president. But there were a number of us made vice president about the same time, so it was a whole new group of young Turks that Mr. Whiteford was bringing into the picture. Not just in the refining side, but in marketing and in production as well. Excuse me, I'm going to take a little break here, if I may.
Oh, wait. Well, you just became vice president at the tender age of 39, as you said. You did talk a little bit about your part of the unpleasant part that you had that over that position. Did you have any, I should phrase the question, did you have any particular plan as to how you were going to go about that, or did you just sort of feel your way as it developed?
It was a matter of feeling my way as it developed. We were all in, there were several of us that were involved, the operating man, the coordinator, and the senior vice president, our boss, and I were all in a new situation, and we kind of had to learn to work together. And we had our tussles from time to time, a little competition here and there. We were organization chart wise, we were all competitive for the top job, and that's not always a situation that you like to find yourself in, but it's the nature of the beast. Mm-hmm. And we worked it out. Other fellows that were involved were all first class gentlemen, and we got along fine. They were good friends of mine, as both before. After, interestingly enough, the operating man, vice president of operations, was Bonner Barnes, and he was a chemical engineer from Texas A&M that my father had hired in the Port Arthur refinery in years gone by, and he worked for Dad. And as I was a kid growing up, he frequently came and babysat me and my brother and sister. He was a good friend of the family, and he was one of our babysitters. Of course, at that time, Dad was the big boss, and he could ask a young engineer to come and babysit and get away from it, which he did. And therefore, there was a certain relationship there that both Bonner Barnes and I had to handle with some delicacy, because he remembered me as being this kid that he used to babysit for. I remembered him as being the babysitter and a big shot in the refinery, relatively speaking. And therefore, he was considerably my senior. And of course, he knew infinitely more about the refinery than I ever would. And I had to be pretty careful, being a young whippersnapper, as it were, particularly with the research background, some might say stigma, to be careful that I didn't tread on his toes or his people's toes. And that was sometimes a very tricky thing. I mean, it was a test of diplomacy, which sometimes I didn't quite meet as satisfactorily as I would have liked. The first coordinator was a man named Kerberg, Slim Kerberg, who was an engineer and a gentleman who unfortunately succumbed to lung cancer, but he was succeeded as coordinator by Bob Dorsey, who later became chairman and whom I succeeded as chairman and CEO of Gulf. But he was more on the operating side, and they'd come up through the Venezuelan refinery in part. But we were good friends and worked together. We'd been good friends and Port Arthur when we were both in the engineering bullpen together. That was one of the characteristics of Gough that I found very interesting. That bullpen of young engineers where everybody started out was a great source of people for Gough over the years. Practically everybody who came into responsible positions in the refining side, process product side of Gulf in later years went through that particular bullpen. Now the production side was a completely different fraternity, but most of the refining people came through the Port Arthur bullpen. And again, referring to my dad, among his assignments as technical guru, as it were, the Port Arthur refinery, he was largely responsible for technical recruiting at one stage of the game. And he and incidentally, Bob Dorsey teamed up in the post-war years, immediate post-war years, as a team to recruit technical people for Gulf. And particularly, of course, the Southwest schools where they knew people and had contacts. And they hired a great many of the, and Dad in particular, and then Bob Dorsey with him later on, they hired some of their top people. As a matter of fact, one of their hires was Jim Lee, who succeeded me as chairman of Gulf. So Gulf was a very much a family company in those years. And therefore, the ties in Gulf to the company and to the people in Gulf were perhaps a bit unique in industrial circles. It was more of a family institution than most big companies.
Employee loyalty. How far did that extend down? I mean, did
all
it permeate
the
whole company?
All the way. A very, very important factor over the years. Yes, sir. If you were a Gulf man, you were a Gulf man. And proud of it. This, I guess, started from the Mellons, but it extended throughout the whole organization. Yes, definitely. A major characteristic of the company.